Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other business today. For all your gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Thursday, July 20, 2023. 27 years ago, my wonderful daughter was born. So happy birthday to Hannah. Have a great year. And listeners, happy Pennsylvania Day. Yes, we could have acknowledged Lollipop Day or Get to Know Your Customer Day, but we've done that in previous years. So as a native Penn Woodsman, Melody's a native Penn Woods woman, I'm going to take the liberty of celebrating the second state to join the Union way back when. Once home of the temporary nation's capital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is also known as the Keystone State. Remember that for future Jeopardy episodes. While the source of the nickname has been forgotten, its meaning is certainly not lost. Bridge builders certainly know leaving the vital Keystone out of their structure would be folly, leading to collapse. Pennsylvania played many roles in history that could be considered keystones as well. To begin with, its vote for independence was split between 8 delegates. And because of that, the split played a vital role in deciding to move toward independence and cementing the union of the newly formed country. And as we know, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution were signed in Philadelphia during its brief time as the capital. So come visit us. There's plenty to see, do, and eat all across our Commonwealth. We'd love to see you, and I think you'd love us as well. So happy PA Day, everyone. Let's get to today's market report. First, in the special metals market, up and down day, mostly down. After hitting a high of 1982 early this morning, gold finished down about $8 in the New York spot aftermarket at, we'll call it 1,970. Silver down 1%, 1.7 actually, $24.79. Platinum down $18 at $9.65. Palladium down $30 at $1,306. And certainly gold's we won't call it a correction, but it's a slide today, coming on the back of an increasing U.S. dollar index up about a half a percent at 100.83. Certainly explains a lot of that, in addition to some profit-taking from gains over the last few days. Other commodities, oil up again, about a third of a percent at $75.63. Natural gas up 5.25%, $2.74. The 10-year yield, treasury yield up 0.1 at 3.85. The 2-year yield up, about 0.08 at 4.8. And boy, the 3-month, the 90-day, 91-day, up fairly steady, up 0.04 of a point at 5.4. Still showing that severely inverted curve. And in the paper markets today, bear with me while this page refreshes. The Dow Jones up about a half a percent, 164 points at 35,225. NASDAQ down about 2%, 14,063. It sank almost 300 points. And as a result, the overall S&P 500 down about 0.7 of a percent, 31 points. 4,500, we'll call it 35. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Coins Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, excuse me, a lot of news out there, most of it financial, some not. We're going to talk about home sales, the Chinese economy, jobless claims, corporate America cutting costs, and Saudi execs hitting U.S. corporate boards. Certainly an eye-opener. We'll start with existing homes, where National Association of Realtors reported today the sales of existing homes dropped a little over 3% in June compared with May, running at a seasonally adjusted annualized rate of about 4.16 million units. Compared with June last year, sales were about 19% lower. That's the slowest sales pace for June since 2009, when we typically see sales picking up in most markets. Continued weakness in the housing market is certainly not for lack of demand. It's all about a critical shortage of supply, as we talked about earlier this week. There were just 1.1 million homes for sale at the end of last month, 14% less than last year at this time. At the current sales pace, that represents a 3.1-month supply compared to a 6-month supply, which is considered balance between buyer and seller. Lawrence Young, who we often quote, he's the chief economist for the Realtors, said there simply aren't enough homes for sale. The market can easily absorb a doubling of inventory. Well, that dynamic is keeping pressure under home prices. The median price of an existing home sold in June, $410,200, second highest price ever recorded. Last June's price was about 1% higher, so it is down a tad. However, this median measure also reflects what's selling, and right now, with mortgage rates a lot higher than last year, the low end of the market is the most active. And according to the Realtors, sales are unlikely to recover anytime soon as mortgage rates weigh heavy on affordability. Mortgage rates hung in the mid to upper 6% range during this time period, and then shot up. That was back in April and May, and then shot up over 7% at the end of the month, stayed in that 7% range for all of June, even as home prices rose. Again, first-time buyers struggling the most. Their share of June sales fell to 26% from 30% a year ago. That's the lowest share since Realtors began tracking this metric. The higher end of the market, however, appears to be recovering. While sales were down across all price points, they were down the least at the highest end. Oh, excuse me. So, Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal, who I believe writes very pithy columns a couple times a week, writes today about Nomura's chief economist Richard Ku's recent warning. He said, quote, until we find out why Chinese companies stop borrowing money, it's very difficult to predict where the Chinese economy is going. As Ku sees it, China now faces the risk of a Japan-style balance sheet recession, a scenario in which large amounts of debt could weigh on the country's economic growth for years to come. That's big news. As evidence of this dynamic, Ku points to the fact that China's private companies appear to have begun cutting back on their borrowing 7 years ago. The businesses avoiding investment in order to pay down their debts is thought to be a classic sign of balance sheet recession, and it's also one reason why they've historically been so tough to stamp out. Now, it may make sense for a single company to focus on paying off its individual debts, but if everyone's doing it at the same time, it tends to tank growth, particularly at a time when it's sorely needed. And with China coming out of its zero COVID policy, they need all the help they can get. But of course, the exact reasons why Chinese companies aren't borrowing are important, and here the jury's still out. China's leadership famously cracked down on several high-profile industries in order to curb what Wiesenthal calls disorderly growth in capital. Now, as economic growth stalls there, it appears policymakers are attempting to reverse or at least help a number of previous directives. New public support measures for the flagging property market there, something which Ku has advocated for as a way of avoiding balance sheet recession, were introduced last week, and overnight we've seen a new attempt at addressing the regulatory uncertainty that appears to have chilled a big chunk of China's private sector. Yesterday, Pony Ma, the billionaire co-founder of Tencent, said the private economy is an important force to promote economic and social development. There's no mistaking the symbolism there. Tencent, one of the companies most affected by the tech crackdown. In case there was any doubt, China's leaders also vowed yesterday to treat private companies the same as state-owned enterprises. And that leaves just one of Ku's possible reasons behind Chinese corporate silence still unaddressed. The idea that Chinese businesses may be pulling back because of decoupling fears and the de-risking of supply chains. Intuitively, it seems like this might be a place where China policymakers have less control, Wiesenthal concludes, but it will nevertheless be an interesting one to see if they attempt to tackle trade head on. Well, it's Jobless Claims Thursday. A few Americans applied for unemployment benefits last week, with the labor market continuing to cruise along despite higher interest rates intended to cool it. Cool hiring, that is. Applications for initial jobless claims fell by 9,000 people to 228,000 for the week ending July 15th, from 237,000 the previous week, according to Labor Department numbers out today. The four-week moving average of claims, which evens out some of the weekly volatility, fell by close to 10,000 to 237,500. For 3 weeks in late May and early June, jobless claims had appeared to reach a sustained higher level above 260,000. But in the past 4 weeks, claims have retreated, and the labor market remains upbeat. Since more than 20 million jobs vanished when the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020, employers have added jobs at a blistering pace, more often than not beating forecasts. And despite the fastest interest rate hike since the late 80s, the unemployment rate has hardly budged and remains historically low, even though there are still far too many discourage job seekers without work. But a report, Fed officials have said that the headline unemployment rate needs to rise well above 4% to bring inflation down to an acceptable level. But a report last week showed that consumer prices fell to their lowest levels since early 2021, 3% in June, and much closer to the Fed's target of 2%. In June, the Fed chose not to increase its benchmark borrowing rate for the first time in 15 months, though some officials and 99% the Fed Fund future traders say they expect the Fed to add 25 basis points to their rates next week, taking it up to a max of 5.5%. Outside the tech sector, we know McDonald's, Morgan Stanley, 3M have recently shed employees. And overall, about 1.75 million people were collecting unemployment benefits the week that ended July 8th. It's about 33,000 more than the previous week. Some mixed signals there. Well, corporate America appears to be slimming down to keep those profits coming. Companies with investment-grade credit ratings reduced operating expenses by over 5.1% in the first quarter, to $2.86 trillion. That's according to an S&P Global Market Intelligence report released this week. S&P's findings indicate that many companies are cutting costs around the edges on things like hiring and business travel rather than executing wholesale layoffs or deep operational cuts. It also comes at a sensitive time with, again, the jury still out on whether the Fed's aggressive tightening campaign will lead the economy into a recession or a soft landing. We have businesses with weaker balance sheet not cutting as much, possibly because they don't have as much fat to trim. The companies with non-investment grade credit ratings shed only 3.8% of their operating expenses. But the energy and consumer discretionary sectors were especially aggressive in slashing costs, reducing expenses by 13 and 10% respectively. Companies like Disney, FedEx, Dell Computers have initiated cost cuts in recent months by some combination of shedding employees. They've also ended certain operations and reduced spending broadly. In some cases, expense reductions reflect passive changes like decline in energy expenses. But operating expenses still grew as a percentage of revenue for investment-grade companies, rising just shy of 1 percentage point. 91.4%. That means companies didn't entirely counterbalance the slide in business with more reductions, but expect the cutting to continue, although with sustained strength in the job market, despite the slowing pace of job growth, that suggests that companies are still hesitant to cut too much. Excuse me. And here's an eye-opener mentioned at the top of the show. The boss of Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil giant is joining the board of BlackRock. Of course, the mega U.S. hedge fund is getting Saudi Aramco CEO Amin Nasser to replace Badr al-Saad, who's chair of the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development, who is departing when his term expires next year. Now, with more than $9 trillion in assets under management, BlackRock has emphasized its commitment to responsible environment, social, and governance-based investing. But BlackRock CEO Larry Fink has recently tried to distance the company from the hot-button term as political backlash builds against ESG. Saudi Arabia is also under scrutiny for its human rights record, as well it should. Nasser led Saudi Aramco's record large IPO, and he's directed the company's push for net zero emissions by 2050. But he's also argued that alternatives are not ready to shoulder a heavy load of growing energy demand, and therefore we need to work in parallel until alternatives are ready. That is, alternative fuels and the vehicles that run on them. BlackRock Spink was a vocal proponent of ESG, but he recently told the Aspen Ideas Festival that he won't use the term anymore. Hey, music means it's time for a short break. We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, 1-800-375-4188 for all your precious metal needs. Or check out our website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is poker. Yes, poker, the card game, or more specific, life lessons learned by Axios CEO Jim Vandeheim playing poker over the years. Now, before he ran a news organization, Jim was a reporter, and a good one. And he says most of what he knows about reporting he learned from playing poker. He says the poker table's a classroom filled with invaluable life lessons. One, you learn to read people. The famous poker champion Doyle Brunson said, "Show me your eyes and you may as well show me your cards." So if you sit around a table long enough, you start to read people's eyes and twitches, their tendencies and styles, their strengths and weaknesses. So think of poker as a fun way to sharpen your emotional intelligence. Number two, you learn luck. Another poker champ, Phil Hellmuth, said poker is 100% skill and 50% luck. So much of success flows from getting the right break at the right moment, says Vandeheim, and being prepared to pounce on it. He says poker shows how skill can help you win, but only by riding the rhythms of luck can you win big at anything. Now, three, you learn to recognize fact patterns. Actor Ed Norton said, life, like poker, has an element of risk. It shouldn't be avoided. It should be faced. Most people are predictable if you watch them closely enough. With time, you can almost anticipate how people will respond in good or bad situations, just like they do with good or bad cards. Vanderheim says that while the 52 cards are wildly unpredictable, there's a set number with a concrete hierarchy and a knowable probability of success or failure. Same goes for most big life decisions with uncertain variables. Number four, you learn to navigate high pressure. There's something about competition, amplified by a few pennies or dollars at stake, that messes with your mind, especially when they're more than a few dollars. Your blood pressure spikes, competing impulses race through your head, instinct grabs a hold. This is the case for most hands of poker and most tense moment in life. Your brain learns to navigate these moments through trial and error. And number five, and I'm going to give you a heads up, and I apologize for this in advance. It looks like I've got some kind of walking salesperson traversing the neighborhood, and my dog, my very attentive dog, is nearby. So if you hear the loud barks, it'll go away soon. In any event, number five, you learn when to quit. You remember what the late, great Kenny Rogers sang, know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, know when to run. Well, the biggest mistake poker players make is the same one we all make in relationships, jobs, and other bad habits, not knowing when to quit. Sometimes life deals us bad cards. Sometimes we play good cards poorly. Recognizing our own weaknesses and tendencies helps limit the number of dumb moves we make. Good advice. And that's this week's Levity is Golden. Hey, looks like it's too late to save yellow trucking, that is. The Teamsters Union apparently would rather have the company go broke than make any union concessions. Craig Fuller, who's founder and CEO of FreightWaves, American shipper and CEO of Flying Magazine, explains, quote, the company failed to make payments to its pension plans. The Teamsters have threatened to strike on Saturday if not resolved. In its weakened state, doubtful that Yellow can recover from this, end quote. Last month, Teamsters claimed Yellow, one of the largest trucking companies in the U.S., told the union that Yellow could be out of cash by August. To avoid its demise, Yellow's executive team said Teamsters, which represents 22,000 Yellow employees nationwide, must permit operational changes the union previously approved. Teamsters General President Sean O'Brien's response, go ahead and shut down. Now, 12 days later, O'Brien tweeted a picture of a gravestone, Yellow, 1924 to 2023. Now, on the surface, it's mysterious why O'Brien would settle for the company shuttering instead of seeking to retain 22,000 Teamster jobs. After all, unionized trucking jobs are so rare that one might think a so-so union job is better than no union job at all. However, labor experts say this move isn't surprising. Rather, it's a sign that union leaders like O'Brien and Sean Fain, who's president of the UAW, the auto workers, have greatly changed from those of the past decades. Rhetoric has become proudly militant, and jobs that aren't up to Teamster standards won't be tolerated. Well, Yellow isn't the only freight company in a showdown with Teamsters this summer. As we've discussed on this program multiple times recently, the union and UPS have been locked in months of negotiation for its next five-year contract. In fact, UPS employees voted to authorize a strike if no new contract is reached by the expiration of the current one on July 31st. Well, so who's buying the ballooning U.S. government debt that's now approaching $32.5 trillion. There's way too much demand for long-term treasury securities, or else the 10-year yield wouldn't be 3.8%, but 6.8% instead. The 30-year yield would be further north of where it is. Today, however, the Treasury Department, today the Treasury Department sold another $70 billion 4-week, $60 billion 8-week bills, and $17 billion 10-year TIPS. Maybe someday yields will have to rise to lure more buyers. I mean, yield solves all demand issues, doesn't it? If you can't sell them at, 5%, try 5.1, 5.2. Just about anything will sell if the yield's high enough. That's why even junk bonds find eager buyers. But we're not there yet with treasuries. Even foreign buyers are still loading up, particularly in Europe. But China and Japan, the two largest holder of treasuries, have been unloading their stock. Well, in total, all foreign holders held $7.53 trillion in treasuries in May. That's down a hair from the record holdings in April, but up 2.5% roughly from a year ago. Now, by contrast, the holdings of China and Hong Kong combined fell by 6.6% from a year ago, and the holdings of Japan fell by 10.1%. Both countries have for years been losing importance among foreign holders of our nation's debt. Foreign holders just became less crucial. As our debt has ballooned over the years, foreign holdings have increased more slowly. The share of foreign holdings as a percent of the total federal debt has declined from 33% roughly in 2014 to less than 24% in May. Japan's Ministry of Finance last year cashed in some U.S. dollar assets, presumably treasury securities, to beef up its military and defense spending. I don't know, but that's a logical thought. But then it blew $68 billion in dollar cash to buy yen in the foreign exchange market to prop up the yen after it plunged to 150 to the dollar by October. We could see that they prepared for propping up the yen in advance. Japan started cashing out in August last year, and by October, it had unloaded $132 billion in treasuries. Well, since then, its holdings have zigzagged higher again and remain in the historical range. In May, they dipped below $1 trillion, though, down by about 10% from last year. Now, China, we know, has been unloading treasuries for several years. In May, its holding of treasuries fell to $847 billion. That's the lowest going back to 2011, down by 11% from last year. During the capital flight panic in 2016, China sold treasury securities to prop up its currency, the renminbi or yuan. It then brought its holdings back to the declining trend. Since the pandemic, the decline of its holdings has accelerated. Hong Kong's holdings increased by $30 billion year over year, while China's holdings dropped by $105 billion. Their combined holdings fell to $1.06 trillion, matching the prior low points in October and February. The UK is the third largest foreign holder of U.S. debt. The City of London's a global financial center, we know, and so holdings in the UK had reached a new record in March and have dipped for 2 months to $667 billion in May, but still up nearly 5% from last year. Other financial centers in Europe are smaller countries that specialize in handling and often obscuring the financial holdings of global companies, individuals, and governments. And they have huge holdings of treasury securities. And they're not just Europe, too. Ireland's a favorite place for U.S. companies to store their profits and wealth. It holds $245 billion in our debt. Belgium with $335 billion. Luxembourg, $334 billion. Switzerland, $304 billion. And in the Caribbean, the Cayman Islands at $263 billion. Now, other top foreign holders include Canada, whose holdings rose to a new record of $266 billion. And Taiwan, whose holdings dipped for the month to 240, India, whose holdings have been zigzagging higher and are now at a record $238 billion. And Brazil, whose holdings, after dropping for years, bounced off the record low in January and in May rose to $230 billion. Interesting numbers, for sure, ladies and gentlemen, showing once again that international finance, like politics, makes for strange bedfellows. Well, here's another index of how much better than expected some believe the economic news has been lately. Too big to fail, Citigroup's Economic Surprise Index. That's a widely followed indicator that provides a snapshot of how Wall Street views the how the economy is faring against expectations, just hit its highest level in the past 2 years. Higher numbers mean data have been better than expected, lower numbers worse. Well, recent reports on weakening consumer inflation, the slowing wholesale price increases, falling import prices, and lower than expected claims for jobless benefits helped send the surprise index to its highest level in 2 years. It was almost exactly a year ago that the index was blaring alarms that a deep slowdown was in the works, as the Fed sharply raised the interest rates while inflation stayed stubbornly high. At that time, economists began to ratchet up their predictions that a recession was likely coming. But now, well, economists are backing off, a lot of them anyway, are backing off those calls in the face of economic data that has been far perkier than conventional wisdom called for. So what's next? I don't know. Do you? The Preliminary Market Purchasing Managers Index report for July, that's a closely watched survey gauging conditions as seen by inventory managers at manufacturers and service firms, will be released Monday, and that will offer the first read on whether the economy's solid run is continuing into this month. Now, related to this, the stock market's so-called fear gauge or fear index is the lowest since the start of the pandemic. Some say it's another indication of the optimistic psychology that seems to have the upper hand in markets right now and suggests the current rally could prove to be a new bull market. The fear gauge in question is the Chicago Board Options Exchange's VIX Volatility Index. In recent days, it's fallen below 14, territory last seen in February 2020, just before the pandemic exploded in the U.S. The S&P 500 has gained more than 27% off the low it hit on October 12th last year. The benchmark index is just 5% below a new record high, confirmation that market mavens look for before christening a new bull market. Now, the rally doesn't say much about the prospects for corporate profits over the next year. Rather, it seems to be a collective sigh of relief from Wall Street, which now believes the post-pandemic flaming inflation and the Fed rate hikes are once and for all behind us. Time will tell. Oh, patrons at a McDonald's restaurant at a Connecticut rest stop would beg to differ about a rosy inflation outlook. Listen to this. This particular McDonald's has been charging $18 for a Big Mac combo meal, and fast food fans aren't loving it. McDonald's is located off I-95 in Darien, Connecticut, one of the country's wealthiest towns in upscale Fairfield County. It also charges $19 for a quarter pounder with cheese and bacon meal, or a quarter pounder deluxe, both of which include medium fries and soft drink. Other eye-popping prices on the menu there include $18 for a McCrispy sandwich, $18.29 for a 10-piece chicken McNugget nugget meal, and $16.59 for a filet-o-fish sandwich. The cheeseburger usually found on the $1 menu is going for $17 for two. On Grubhub, the items are even more expensive. Big Mac meal would set the customer back $21.59, while a double quarter pounder with cheese meal costs $22.79. Add a tip to that, and you have outrageous corporate credit card interest usury rates. And while inflation has shown signs of cooling, food prices nationwide remain stubbornly high. This is certainly a sign of that. McDonald's business model allows franchises to set their own prices. Darien, which is located in Fairfield County, has a median income of $250,000. Well, phew, after that news, I need a break just like you do. Stick around. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. I, too, endorse Melody Cederstrom. She's great, isn't she? She's off the program today taking care of other business. You know where to reach her, though, 1-800-375-4188. Hey, when the pandemic-induced whipsawing of the economy is truly over, if it ever is, and we're back to a world of lower inflation and more steady economic growth, there are some tentative and uncertain reasons to think that interest rates might be higher than what we've become accustomed to. Everything from asset prices to the government's fiscal sustainability would face pressure if the so-called long-term neutral rate of interest, and by extension, the Fed's target interest rate, turns out to be persistently higher than is currently anticipated. That target rate is effectively the cap at which the Fed will step in and lend to banks itself, as opposed to them lending to one another. As a policy tool, the Fed will lower the Fed funds rate target to help stimulate the economy during an economic slowdown, as it makes money easier and cheaper to borrow. where the Fed can raise the target rate in response to an overheating economy or to fight high inflation by making money more expensive to borrow, much as it has been since March last year. Now, the target or terminal rate is a longer-term target, while the current rate is the short-term rate. The terminal rate is meant to represent the neutral interest rate where prices are stable and full employment is achieved, the dual mandate. At their policy meeting last month, the median Fed official projected that while their policy interest rate will remain elevated for the next couple of years, in the longer run, it will only be 2.5%. That's the same long-term projections the policymakers made in December 2019. In other words, they essentially expect the interest rate environment to return to the world of the 2010s once this bizarre economic scenario is over. Again, if it ever is. Now, markets broadly agree, apparently, as evidenced by long-term treasury rates that are substantially lower than their shorter-term counterparts, as we mentioned at the top of the program. As of yesterday's market close, the yield on a 10-year Treasury note was 3.76%, 4.78 for 2 years, and 5.45 for 3 months. And the Congressional Budget Office in February projected that short-term interest rates will end up even lower, a mere 2.2% by 2026, which underlies forecasts for the federal budget deficits and debt. Look, what if they're all wrong? Vanguard's global chief economist Joe Davis and three of his colleagues wrote recently that a mix of demographic factors and large budget deficits have driven the long-run neutral interest rate upward. By their math, the long-run Fed policy rate is actually 3.5%. And they say a higher neutral rate will require the Fed to tighten monetary policy more aggressively than presently anticipated. And that, they continue, will potentially dampen the economic outlook in the short run, requiring a swift adjustment from private sector participants. Now, some Fed officials themselves are starting to come around to a similar view, even if it's not yet a consensus position of the Federal Open Market Committee. In June, one official saw the long-term policy rate at 3.625 and another at 3.25. A year earlier, none saw the long-term rate being above 3%. Well, earlier this week, Matthew Lazzetti, Matthew Raskin, and Amy Yang of Too Big to Fail Deutsche Bank noted this. While revisions over time to the median longer-run dot plot may or may not convey important information about factual future neutral rates, they would likely fuel market focus on the issue and support increases in long-term rates. Bottom line, if interest rates end up persistently higher than is now widely anticipated, it would mean a correction ahead for the stock and bond markets and new pressure to rein in federal budget deficits. So be prepared, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure you have plenty of gold and silver in your nest egg. Insure yourself against another venture. Hey, our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets earlier this week. In addition to Doug Nolan's Credit Bubble Bulletin blog and Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought on AI and viruses, you'll find Melody's weekly recap of the markets. Plus, my weekly insights column takes a look at how recent post-pandemic challenges for the Federal Reserve differ from what it faced during and after the Great Recession. It's based on excerpts from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities updated chart book, which tracks the recovery from the so-called short but deep pandemic recession. Now, we recall how the pandemic upended our lives and economy, as well as those of people all around the world. The largely mandated shutdowns in early 2020 caused a devastating reduction of economic activity and huge job losses not seen since the Great Depression. The downturn came as government restrictions and citizens' fear of the virus kept people at home and businesses and schools shut, both here and abroad. Workers in jobs that paid lower wages and required face-to-face encounters with consumers were especially affected. hospitality and retail industries. Now, those facing massive employment and earnings losses were disproportionately women, workers of color, workers without a bachelor's degree, and foreign-born workers. Congress, the White House, and the Fed all enacted significant fiscal and monetary relief measures in 2020 and 21 to prevent the economy from facing a depression and to relieve hardships faced by those everyday Americans. Most economists agree that those actions helped fuel an economic recovery starting as early as May that year, making the deepest recession in the post-World War II era also the shortest, although some industries may beg to differ. Now, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, which we know is the consensus arbiter of official business cycle dating, the economic downturn lasted just 2 months, March and April 2020. On the one hand, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, says the expansion in economic activity in the recovery from the pandemic recession was stronger and quicker than initial forecasts. They say those cautious projections may have been tainted by the Great Recession of 2007-9, which at the time was the worst recession since the Great Depression. The recovery from which also was disappointingly slow, with high unemployment in the range of 6-9%, that's headline employment too, lasting several years after the economy began to grow. On the other hand, CBPP points out that the causes of and policy responses to the two recessions couldn't have been more different. For one thing, the global financial crisis in 2008 turned a mild recession into the Great Recession, while a global public health crisis brought on the pandemic recession more recently. For another, as the CBPP adds, the recovery following the Great Recession was impeded by the lingering effects of a burst housing bubble and banking crisis on households' income and wealth and on bank lending. Those two factors, among others, hampered growth in consumer spending and business investment, two significant factors in the size of economic growth. Now, fast forward to 2020. The ebbs and flows of the pandemic economy was influenced by, virus caseloads and the extent of lockdowns and social distancing measures to address it. As public health gradually improved, business and consumer activity began to pick up fairly quickly. And there was the federal government's fiscal response to the Great Recession, particularly the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, and the 2009 Recovery Act, which the CBPP notes was large for its time and effective at arresting an even sharper downturn. But the chart book adds, but it was neither large enough nor sustained enough to promote a rapid recovery with stronger growth. Now, the response to the pandemic recession. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I beg your pardon. Now, the response to the pandemic recession, including the CARES Act and, three other laws enacted in March and April 2020, plus a December 2020 package and the 2021 American Rescue Plan, was a lot bigger. Does that mean, as the CBPP suggests, that policymakers had learned key lessons from the Great Recession? Maybe some, but luck has a place in this discussion, as do unintended consequences. And the Fed took similar action in both recessions, cutting its benchmark interest rate for monetary policy effectively to zero and implementing large-scale purchases of government bonds, also known as quantitative easing. Without enough fiscal support from Congress, though, the easing of monetary policy fell short of stimulating a quick recovery or raising the inflation rate to the Fed's policy target of 2% after the Great Recession. Remember that during a good part of that time, inflation was sub 2%, or actually trying to get it. In contrast, the CBPP notes these policies, together with strong fiscal stimulus, supported a much faster recovery from the pandemic recession. More than a decade after the Great Recession and before the pandemic, inflation was just too subdued for the Fed. Again, it struggled to reach its policy target of 2%, which it believed was appropriate for the smooth functioning of the economy. And then came early 2021. Growing demand for goods and services crashed into severe supply snafus, and inflation exploded, rising far above 2%. As many other economists viewed the surge in inflation as temporary, predicting that high inflation would be a transient event and that inflation would soon return to around 2%. Well, monthly changes in inflation did cool a tad in that summer, but then rose back to a worryingly high rate, one we hadn't seen and experienced in four decades. Well, the annual change in the CPI peaked at 9.1% in June last year as energy prices skyrocketed. Of course, inflation has come down a lot since then, and as we've noted, it's just 3% as of the end of last month. Well, during the Great Recession's aftermath, the Fed loosening of monetary policy was theoretically consistent with realizing the Fed's dual-mandated goals of both high employment and also stable prices. That required them to lower unemployment and raise the inflation rate. That was also the case after the pandemic recession. But the development of high inflation in 2021 created a more challenging scenario for the Fed and its monetary policy, requiring them to lower inflation while maintaining high employment. So the Fed reversed its expansionary policy in March last year, began raising its Fed fund rate target, which has gone from a range of 0 to 0.25% to 5 to 5.25%. Probably up to 5.5% by the end of next week. It's also reduced its massive holdings of long-term assets of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, also a process known as quantitative tightening. The Fed's balance sheet has fallen from its April 2022 peak of just shy of $9 trillion to $8.3 trillion last week. Well, since the onslaught of QT, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has and have stressed that they'll do whatever is necessary to keep higher inflation from becoming a new normal. Perhaps more importantly, the CBPP says that even with strong job growth, challenges remain to achieve a full and equitable recovery and ongoing economic expansion. Well, the next Fed policy making meeting starts next week. As of today, 99.8% of Fed fund future traders believe the Fed will raise rates another 25 basis points, again, to an upper range of 5.5%. Count me among that group. Although, you know what? Another 6 to 12 weeks of holding rates steady wouldn't be the end of our world. Certainly. The world as we've come to know it in this, well, evolving new normal. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody be back tomorrow with Butch and Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs to close out the week. Also be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks as always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. Happy birthday to my lovely daughter, Hannah. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. Pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. Got me a wealthy